From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, sitting in for Terry Gross. During the 1960s, New York Times reporter Gloria Emerson brought passionate intelligence to her coverage of Vietnam's war horrors. On today's Fresh Air, Emerson tells tales of new horrors sweeping up Israelis and Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Also, biologist William Jordan peeps into the world of mating medflies, ponders marital incompatibility among the gulls, and wonders whether men matter more than monkeys. And linguist Jeff Nunberg wishes we still use some of the words we used to. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Emergency officials in Bangladesh say that a powerful typhoon has killed at least 1,000 people and left millions without homes. The storm tore into Bangladesh with winds of 145 miles per hour and waves as high as 20 feet. It struck just after midnight and battered coastal areas for more than 8 hours. Officials say that at least 5,000 fishermen are still unaccounted for. Their boats were at sea when the typhoon struck. The death toll is rising from Monday's earthquake in the southern Soviet Republic of Georgia. The earthquake measured more than 7.0 on the Richter scale, and officials say that at least 80 people are dead. The region around the quake's epicenter is remote, and some villages remain cut off. The BBC's Bridget Kendall says that the full extent of Monday's earthquake is just now becoming clear.
Local officials report the death toll so far as over 100 dead and 250 injured. But they stress that rescue teams helped by the Soviet army are still digging through the rubble in remote areas, and in some cases entire villages appear to have collapsed. One report said one village simply disappeared into the hillside, killing all 20 or so residents and leaving only two small children unharmed. The epicenter of this powerful earthquake appears to be in the mountains of northwest Georgia, in a triangular area that ironically includes the troubled region of South Ossetia, where dozens have already died in the last 6 months as the result of ethnic clashes. More than 2,000 troops and medical workers are now searching for victims and ferrying supplies to local people, many of whom have lost their homes in the three tremors that shook the region on Monday afternoon and evening.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall. Algeria has denied that its nuclear research is meant for anything other than peaceful purposes and has offered to throw its nuclear facilities open to international inspection. Western reports say Algeria has begun a nuclear weapons program with Chinese help. Peter Hyatt reports from Tunis.
Officials from the Ministry of Scientific Research say the plant at the center of the allegations is being built with Chinese help in a research complex 160 miles south of Algiers. But they say that it is peaceful, not military, and that Algeria is ready to freely open all its nuclear research facilities to international inspection. This is the most detailed denial yet from the Algerian authorities of Western reports quoting intelligence services, which say the plant is apparently designed to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. A British newspaper on Sunday said Algeria would be able to build its first nuclear bomb by 1998 and one a year thereafter. Although both Algeria and China have already denied these reports, the issue has continued to cause concern. For National Public Radio, this is Peter Hyatt.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points today to close at 2,887.87. This is NPR News. The Federal Reserve acted today to lower interest rates in two key areas. The first cut was a 0.5% drop in the discount rate from 6 to 5.5%. The discount rate is the interest that the Fed charges to commercial banks. Later in the day, the Fed moved to reduce the federal funds rate by adding reserves to the banking system. The federal funds rate is the interest that banks charge each other for loans. Analysts said that the Fed appeared to be aiming to bring the federal funds rate down from 6 to 5.75%. In New York City, hundreds of people gathered in downtown Manhattan to protest Governor Mario Cuomo's proposed state budget cuts. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
At the front of the rally, New York City's union leaders, community activists, and students joined hands with Jesse Jackson in a protest march that extended for several blocks. The protesters chanted, "Tax the rich," and called on Governor Cuomo to find other ways of closing the state's $6.5 billion budget gap. Governor Cuomo has proposed $4.5 billion in budget cuts that would directly impact schools, libraries, healthcare, and parks. According to Dennis Rivera, president of the Health and Hospital Workers Union, if Governor Cuomo instead raised taxes for the wealthiest half of New York's population, social devastation for working people could be avoided.
We have an incredible contradiction. We pay the largest share of the taxes, and now they want to cut our services. So, you know, you can't have it both ways.
According to some union leaders facing the pressure of escalating demonstrations, Governor Cuomo has agreed to meet with union officials later this week. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
The Israeli army said today that an elderly French tourist was stabbed to death in Bethlehem. The report said that the woman was killed by an Arab attacker in a restaurant in the town's main square. Bethlehem's mayor condemned the attack, saying it was the first such killing in the 24 years since Israel first occupied the town. Tourism in the area has fallen during the more than three-year uprising against the occupation. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Through much of the Vietnam War, Gloria Emerson was one of the lions of American journalism, an unrelenting witness to the graphic horrors being played out on the Indochinese Peninsula. Her 1977 book on the impact of the war on Americans, called Winners and Losers, won her a National Book Award and a lasting place in American social history. Then, in 1989, Gloria Emerson returned to the territory of suffering and death, to the Gaza Strip, one of the Palestinian homelands which since 1967 has been under Israeli military occupation. Her book about this latest journey is called Gaza, A Year in the Intifada. Gloria Emerson, why did you write this book?
I don't know why. I didn't know why, but the real reason is I'd seen Palestinian camps in Lebanon 30 years before, and just shut it out of my mind and thought, I cannot begin to write about the Palestinians. It's too complicated. It will make too many people angry. It's too difficult a subject. And then when the uprising began in December 1987, of course, I was watching it on television. And oddly enough, it was the reporting of my old friend from Vietnam, Bob Simon, of CBS, and especially from Gaza, that made me think, I have to overcome this need not to know. I will make one last effort. I will go into the world of Palestinians, and I will write a record. I will write about a resistance that continues, even if we don't hear about it. I will write about an occupation. You see, I'd never seen an occupation. I'd seen four wars, but not an occupation.
Well, you stayed in a small hotel called the Marna
Hotel.
House. Right.
Yes.
And that was a focal point, I gather, for much that is going on in Gaza.
Well, it's the focal point for the upper middle class and people who are hired to lead the delegations around. To understand Gaza, I think you have to go into the camps. And two of the camps in town are called Beach Camp or Shati and Jabalia. And the Palestinians have a very vocal culture. So although interviews sometimes lasted as long as 5 to 6 hours, it was a pleasure to hear how they used language. Arabic is a language of expression, not always a language of fact. And they speak with great poetry. And it may be too sugary for American taste, but I find it quite stunning.
Well, give us some pictures of what you saw there of these people, of the woman who ran this hotel, of the people who you met in these camps, and what is their life like?
I remember one interview with a very sort of slender, rather fierce-looking young man with a beard and a rather wild look in his eyes, and I was quite timid in his presence. He had earned a living as a tailor, and his wife helped him. And he lived in Beach Camp, and he had this most wretched story to tell. He had been in prison. This is a mark of honor, not a mark of criminality. And one night, his small daughter was running a very high fever, so the tailor was anxious to get her to a hospital. And a neighbor in this densely crowded camp said, "Look, I think I see an ambulance." You know, sometimes Red Crescent, the Red Cross, would send ambulances around at night. And, of course, there's always a curfew. And the man rushed out, thinking there might be an ambulance circling around, that he could take the child to the hospital and he was shot by an Israeli soldier.
For violating the curfew.
By violating the curfew, although he was holding the child up in clear view. He was shot by the Israeli soldier and had a very severe fracture. Then the worst thing is that he didn't recover very well. He lacked calcium. He was a bad patient. Then he got a summons to appear in court for violating the curfew. Now, I found this the most startling story. A great wrong was done to him. The soldier must have seen the child. He shot the man holding the child. And then the poor tailor, with a badly fractured leg, received a summons to appear in court. And the violation was, of course, that he had broken the curfew. And the curfew is a deadly thing. You step out of your door at night, as one man did after a quarrel with his wife, to smoke a cigarette and calm down, sort of cool-off period, just outside his own door in beach camp. And three Israeli soldiers set upon him. And you could hear the screaming, and no one dared move.
Now, you witnessed this.
I did not witness it. I was, shall we say, in the vicinity. I heard the screaming and wanted to go out and was prevented, because if I did, then it would mean trouble for the family I had been spending the night with. So one, you know, sort of one quickly sees how deformed the lives of Palestinians are, and that there is no justice, and that it's a very cruel army of occupation, almost an angry army.
Did you talk to the Israeli authorities about this case?
No, I did not. I stayed out of their view. Remember, I went there alone. I wasn't Miss Emerson of the New York Times or Miss Emerson on assignment for a magazine. I was just Miss Emerson. And in order to get the Palestinian side of it, I did not wish to be seen talking to the Israelis. This is just a book about the Palestinian perspective. And what they say, of course, every time I wrote about an incident, I checked it 14 times with eyewitnesses. The Israeli soldier may have been frightened of the dark. The tailor is frightened of the dark. The child was frightened of the dark. But it was tragic, and it seemed to be incredibly illustrative of the degraded lives that men lead in Gaza. It's harder for them than for the women.
Do you think the Palestinian leaders or their Arab allies in the Middle East, do you think they hold any responsibility for the horrible situations you've described facing Palestinians?
I think that the Palestinians believed the promise, but there has not been anyone who gave them any confidence, and they're quite bitter about it since President Nasser of Egypt. Middle-aged men in Gaza often told me how they had been betrayed by their Arab brothers. So that they have this feeling of sort of isolation and helplessness, and they don't support these feelings with great tolerance. And their children, of course, will support them with even less tolerance. The book is only a small record about pain and suffering and resistance and this vision that they seem to have in Gaza of a homeland. And I had never covered an occupation, as I said, and found it so depressing and so frightening to see people whose heads must be slightly bowed at all times. After a while, I began to realize how men kept certain blank expressions on their face, because if you have too sullen or hostile an expression, you could be called over. You realize, of course, that if you're a Gazan, you can be arrested, no charges, no habeas corpus, and sent to prison for a year. It's known as an administrative detainee, and it was a practice started by the British during their mandate in Palestine. And then when the year is up, still you don't know the reason why, your sentence can be prolonged even further.
Do you think the Palestinians have been well served by their leaders, principally in the PLO?
I have not met Yasser Arafat, and I do not wish to speak on his behalf. He puzzles me.
But you've been there, and you're in a position to evaluate the leadership and how well it has served the Palestinian cause.
The Gazans are fiercely independent. They're subversives in the eyes of the Israelis. They're mutinous. We never talked of Yasser Arafat. What we talked about was their deep allegiance to the PLO. The PLO is not outside them. The PLO is their skin. It's their heart. Look, you see, I'm talking like a Palestinian. And there were pictures of Yasser Arafat put up all through the town of Gaza, quite illegal, of course. And I think whoever is the head of the PLO will be a symbol to them of the struggle. No, I don't think they've been particularly well served at all. But they are a remarkable people, and they are stoic and resourceful. I was very interested in how they carried on their resistance. And a very small example is a woman knitted the Palestinian flag, which is forbidden, and made a wristband for the baby. And I only noticed that because so many people leaned over the fat wrist of the baby to kiss it. And, of course, they were kissing the flag.
My guest is Gloria Emerson. She is the author of a new book called Gaza, A Year in the Intifada. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Gloria Emerson is my guest. She has been a longtime war correspondent for the New York Times in the 1950s and 60s, and most recently in the Gaza Strip, a homeland to the Palestinians. You write about a Palestinian lawyer, Raji Surani.
Yes.
Who is he?
He's a remarkable man who is now 36. He recently spent 6 months in New York at Columbia on a fellowship, and it wasn't until he came to this country that I realized how strange freedom was to him, how he'd been arrested 4 times. And he is quite pure, you see. He didn't want to join the armed wing of Fatah or any other group. He believes in the law, and he persists in going to defend Palestinian prisoners in the Israeli military courts, which, as we all know, is a completely futile business. But he believes in the law, and he persists in this, and he wants to hold in Israeli courts the Israeli army to account. And it's quite a remarkable and futile task, but he persists, and thus he becomes a rather heroic man in my eyes. He was treated badly by the Shin Bet, the Israeli FBI, so to speak, and was badly beaten and has suffered from headaches. So I took him myself at my own expense to a neurologist who said he had scar tissue on the right side of his brain, possibly from blows.
Now, you know, there have been many reports that
yes.
Raji Surani's work is financed by the PLO.
Well, actually, it's not. And it would be better for him if it was, but it's not.
How you say that in the book, and you quote him as saying where his money comes from. But how do you know? As a journalist, how did you determine who?
Because I talked
him?
To his mother, who knows everything. You can always go to a Palestinian mother, and she will fully inform you. And anyway, I attributed the quote to him, and I really didn't find it important where the financing came from. It's not a huge, swanky law firm. It doesn't even have a computer or enough telephones. It's a series of dingy rooms and very involved lawyers. They work in minimal conditions. It's quite shocking.
But I'm actually asking you a kind of journalistic technique question here, because actually in the book you say that it's not in quotations when you say that he is not financed by the PLO or any other organizations. It's in your language, but simply as a journalist, not as a person of faith in these.
Well, I think there are some.
How did you know it? It's a question that comes up. Many reviewers have brought this up about the book. How do you really know the things that you're being the things you're being told by these Palestinian people are true?
In most cases, when people, as in the case of the tailor, said he had been shot, I went and saw his medical records and had them translated, talked to the doctor who treated him, talked to 6 eyewitnesses, talked to him, and talked to the 6 eyewitnesses independently. In the case of Raji Surani, I was able to verify that the PLO does not give him any money, but I deeply regret to say that I cannot tell you how I found that out. And it doesn't matter to me whether it's true or not true. He may take some private clients. He may take private contributions from other Arabs. And he may use some income from his own land. But since I no longer work for the New York Times, I do not have to stand behind that, and I don't think it's important, and I know that he does not take money from the PLO. Perhaps it would be better if he did. Most lawyers in Gaza do. I don't see anything criminal with this. It just so happens he doesn't.
It's not a question of whether it's criminal or not. It's a question of how you come to believe how you come to sort out amongst
all of these stories.
Well,
his English is very good. Well, I mean, I'm sorry you picked on this small point.
I really cannot reveal
how I confirmed this, and I'm sorry. Mm. But I can say in other cases the book may contain inaccuracies of one kind or another. But I would say if there are inaccuracies, it's still an extremely truthful book, and it took a very long time to report.
Yet we never meet. See, the thing is, we never seem to meet an Israeli on his or her own terms. I think of this in somewhat this same context as Stephen Kinzer's recent book about Nicaragua, where we meet Contras and Sandinistas, and we find ourselves inside the souls of each and wrestle with the sort of passionate complexities and the evil that they face. And yet in your book, the only sense of an Israeli is through the mouth of a Palestinian who's been beaten. Even when that Palestinian says something nice about an Israeli, we never seem to have a sense of an Israeli human being whom you would really like. And apparently you didn't talk to many of them.
I talked to many Israelis in Tel Aviv, and I saw many examples of cruelty, and in some cases I did not include them in the book because I'd arrived too late or turned my head away. I'm sorry you feel this way. There is a table that gives the casualties that the United Nations Relief and Works Agency provided, and these numbers are probably too low. I don't think it's a question of evil. I think probably Israeli troops don't like going to Gaza and are often angry and impatient. I myself saw a group of Arab women. I was in a taxi cab coming back to Gaza, whose sons had just been arrested, standing outside the compound of Gaza's central jail, for example, crying and pleading. And then a truck went by with their sons in it. And then Israeli soldiers came running out to chase the women. It was a very small anecdote. And I said to the women, run, run, run. And then the soldiers chased them. And I don't think this was evil, but I still found it very disturbing. And because so little is known about the Palestinians, and because they're always sort of thought of as a subspecies or mad dog terrorist, I thought it would be interesting not to paint a huge canvas, as David Shipler did in his extraordinary book, Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in the Promised Land, but to write a very small book about a short period of time and what the Palestinian perspective was. I could not have written Tom Friedman's book, and I could not have written David Shipler's wonderful book. I wanted to do something quite different, just a very small narrative record of how Palestinians see themselves and their lives and their fate.
When you were in Gaza, you say you didn't, as a rule, talk to Israeli soldiers.
I did not wish to come to their attention.
But what were you afraid of?
Israeli soldiers are not particularly cordial to the American press. In fact, they feel that they have helped the Arabs very much. There's some bitterness there. And I did not want to be taken to headquarters, and I did not want to be searched, and I didn't want my notebooks looked at, because I have changed some names in the book, as is apparent when one reads it, and I did not want them to find the real names of people in my notebooks. And so I tried to stay out of their way. And they could have easily sent me out of there. I mean, they can do anything. I want to just read you something, if I may, in reply to your early charges that I did not talk to the Israelis, and this may be a fault. This is a piece by a correspondent, an American Jew named Hal Weiner, and it was in the New York Times on Sunday in October 1989. And he writes, as difficult as it may be to believe, most stories on the Intifada that appear in the Western media are characterized not by exaggeration but by understatement. In spite of this, many non-Jewish correspondents have had to deal with accusations of anti-Semitism, while Jewish journalists, myself included, are censured for self-hatred. And then he makes the point that we all know that people who nurse a hatred of Jews generally do so on the basis of long-standing prejudice, not because of anything the Jews themselves do or do not do. And he says in this remarkable piece that since anti-Semitism has its roots not in the truth but in distortions of the truth, I do not see how I can anyway do a service to the Jewish people by concealing or distorting the truth when it comes to Israel. I am not prepared to sacrifice my own values as a concession to anti-Semites. The issue is not self-hatred but self-respect. I think I did not mean to portray the Israelis as evil. I think there's a danger that all armies of occupation can be menacing to the civilian population. But I think, as David Shipler has made so remarkably clear in his fine book, there is both a similarity and a hatred. I'm sure the Israeli troops hate being in Gaza, and I'm also sure that they do things that they regret. I did not mean to imply that thousands and thousands of men set out every day to commit atrocities, but tempers do run high, and these are not two armed camps facing each other. One is a civilian population, and the other is a very well-equipped army that is completely in power.
I think often when people are in very violent situations, the question of what your role as a journalist is gets very complicated. You speak of urging, at one point, of urging the women to run for their safety. How do you think of yourself as a journalist now?
I think of myself as a writer and one who wishes to report. I told the women to run because they were middle-aged and I could see the troops coming closer. And they were sort of frozen and I didn't think it was a fair match. And so they perhaps didn't understand when I said, oh, run, run. But they understood the wave of my hand and they began this sort of shuffle. It wasn't a very pretty picture. I don't think you yourself would have liked to have been there. And they ran and the soldiers chased after them. It's a small vignette. It's no more than that.
It's a very human response. And it's one that journalists frequently face as to how they should comport themselves to maintain the relationship that they will eventually have with their readers.
But you see, I work for myself, and I don't believe you can be an ethical or honorable human being if you stand by and watch something of that nature occur without trying to help.
You've traveled in Israel, of course.
Yes.
What is
most
your...
happily, and I've even found a kibbutz in Galilee where I would like to spend my declining years, but I'm afraid they won't have me. I said to them, kibbutz Afikim, I could put out a newsletter, and they just laughed. I had a lovely time there.
My guest has been Gloria Emerson. Her new book is called Gaza, A Year in the Intifada. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, filling in for Terry Gross. What do the mating habits of the medfly have to do with us humans? Do gulls divorce for the same reasons we do? And should we sacrifice monkeys for AIDS research? Coming up, a talk with biologist Bill Jordan. He looks to the animal and insect world for insight into human behavior. His new book is Divorce Among the Gulls, an uncommon look at human nature. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg pays homage to words from the past that no one uses anymore. That and more coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United Nations has raised its blue and white flag in northern Iraq today, preparing to take over an American-built camp for Iraqi Kurdish refugees. Thousands of Kurds from the town of Zako have begun going home. The United Nations has opened a humanitarian center for refugees near the Allied tent city at Zako. The move is seen as the first step toward the UN taking over responsibility of the tent city entirely. The 1992 presidential race formally got underway today as former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas announced his candidacy for the Democratic nomination, with stops in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. David Wright of member station WBUR reports.
As the first Democrat to declare his candidacy, Paul Tsongas immediately took the offensive today as he spoke before supporters who gathered in his hometown of Lowell, Massachusetts. The 50-year-old former U.S. Senator lashed out at what he called the cynical avoidance of the Reagan-Bush years.
George Bush promised, read my lips, no new taxes. It won an election. But what he really meant was, read my lips, add new debt. That is generationally immoral.
The Democratic candidate said he is committed to making America a thriving economic power once again. Tsongas, who resigned from the Senate in 1985 to battle cancer, concedes he is a long shot in the presidential race who must overcome several major obstacles. To demonstrate his physical health, the candidate swam last weekend in a master's meet in Indianapolis. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
House Speaker Tom Foley indicated today that he is considering a formal investigation into whether Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign bribed Iran to hold off the release of 52 American hostages until after he was elected. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The allegations that the Reagan campaign conspired with Iran to make sure that hostages weren't released while President Carter was in office gained some credibility recently. Details were made public of an investigation by Middle East scholar and former Carter administration official Gary Sick. In the New York Times and in a PBS program, Sick documented a series of meetings between Reagan campaign officials and Iranians who were seeking access to weapons they couldn't get because of Carter's arms embargo. Sick says that five sources claim George Bush, then vice president, was at one of the meetings. Foley said today he's asked for a review of the matter. He says if significant evidence exists, it should be formally examined. Senator William Cohen, a member of the panel that investigated the Iran-Contra scandal, has also called for an investigation, along with former President Carter. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater shrugged the matter off this week, saying there's no need to investigate something that never happened. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained almost 11 points to close at 2887.87. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The U.S. released its report on state-sponsored terrorism today, and despite improved ties with Damascus, the U.S. kept Syria on the list. Other countries include Iran, Libya, Cuba, North Korea, and Iraq. Countries which appear on the list are subject to some trade sanctions. The report is called Patterns of Global Terrorism 1990, and it points out that there were no spectacular terrorist incidents last year that killed a great number of people, but it warned that the threat of terrorism is still very real. Japanese Prime Minister Toshiki Kaifu met with his Thai counterparts in Bangkok today. He called on their two governments to work together to resolve Cambodia's 12-year-old civil war. Kaifu is on a swing through several Southeast Asian countries. In Bangkok, Mary Kay Magstead has more.
During their 2 hours of talks, Kaifu and Thai Prime Minister Anand Panyarachan pledged their country's continuing friendship and economic cooperation. They also pledged to work together to resolve Cambodia's 12-year-old civil war. Both governments have hosted peace talks, as have France and Indonesia. Thus far, all such talks have ended in frustration. The next round is due to be held in mid-May, probably in Jakarta. To create a more cordial atmosphere, all Cambodian factions have agreed to observe a temporary ceasefire beginning tomorrow. Anand met Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen and guerrilla leaders last week and told them he hoped the ceasefire would be a lasting one. Khai Phu will meet the guerrilla leaders tomorrow. He told Anand his message to all the Cambodians is simple. Strike an agreement soon or the world will lose interest. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
The World Health Organization released a report today looking at the state of health in Africa. Despite some progress in health care, about 3 of every 5 Africans have no access to basic health services. 150 million do not have safe drinking water, and millions suffer from AIDS. The WHO says that life expectancy is rising very slowly. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Writer and biologist Bill Jordan gets upset when he hears humans talking about how birds and animals resemble people, as though dogs, birds, and bugs were imitating their betters. Really, he says, we can learn a lot more about ourselves, from the rituals of mateship to making war, by looking at how human behavior is rooted in the insect and animal world. Jordan has written about behavior and evolution in a slim new volume of essays called Divorce Among the Gulls.
Evolution basically is about relationship and kinship. And the implication of evolution is that the more closely related you are, the more similar you are. But another implication is that animals that are related, that have descended in one way from another, from one another, they're sort of made out of used parts. Like for instance, when evolution wanted to make a bird, he had to take a lizard and make wings out of legs and that kind of thing. So evolution always uses used parts. And my premise is that the human brain has got to be an expansion of the animal mind, primarily of the ape mind. In fact, I think that really human beings are nothing more than exaggerated monkeys, and that's not to slur the monkey.
You talk a lot about you talk about sex and you talk about territory. Mm-hmm. Territory among medflies, even, or among apes. But mm-hmm. Tell us what it is that we can learn from the medfly on the leaf.
Yeah, that particular essay was called, I think, the Tender Macho Medfly Male or something like that. And it was about what's known as female choice. Female choice is now a whole area of research in ethology, in the branch of biology that deals with behavior. And it's been opened up by the influx of women into biology. Men sort of pioneered the field because at that time it was science was primarily a male domain, and men always seemed to look for things like dominance and aggression and territorial defense, aggressive things, and women seemed to be attracted to nurturing things, to social interactions in groups and that kind of thing, male female relationships. Anyhow, the medflies, it turns out, have a very, very typical system where the males get together in a place called a lek, a lekking site. And a lek is a collection of several males who compete, and they sort of establish a dominance hierarchy, a peck order. And then they put out mating pheromones, which seem to attract the females.
Now, pheromones are fragrances to the lay.
Fragrance, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're sexual scents, sexual odor. But anyhow, when they arrive, the dominant male, the one who has won all the battles and sort of ascended to the top position, has the dominant leaf in the middle of this little lekking area. And the females tend to go right to that leaf where he's located. Now, he clings to the underside of the leaf, and the female lands on the top. And he can see her silhouette through the leaf because his leaf always seems to have light shining on it. And the lekking activities occur, by the way, usually between like 9 and 11, and then maybe 2 and 3. And lighting seems to be very important to it. Anyhow, he can see her image, her silhouette through the leaf, and he starts emitting a different sexual odor. And he fans it with these slow, deliberate wing beats so that it wafts around the edges of the leaf and comes over the top, and the female then responds, and she crawls toward the edge, and if she likes what she smells, she crawls under the edge, and now she's facing him. And then he walks toward her, and they sit there face to face, and they start fanning odors back and forth, and probably communicating in other ways, maybe visual ways as well. And finally, if all the courtship steps satisfy the female, the male then does a sort of little vault and jumps onto her back and stays there for a bit, and then he tries to copulate. And at any point, the female can sort of nix the proceedings. Well, if they get locked in copulo, You'd think that there's no more choice, but there is, because, and this is the importance of the mating occurring on the underside of the leaf. Anyhow, if at the last minute she doesn't like what she smells or feels or whatever, she just lets loose of the leaf, and the couple sort of tumbles down and they break apart. So the point is, the female can reject the male at any number of points in this courtship procedure. And it turns out that about 15% of these dominant males, these really sort of big macho guys that have won all the fights with males, for some reason prove unacceptable to the females. And so these males...
Yes, and so what do we conclude here?
Well, the conclusion is that these males don't get to mate and their genes are not passed on. And so the females are actually shaping over the course of time, the course of evolutionary time, they are shaping the kind of male that they want. So, because they simply can say, you're not going to mate with me, Buster, and so your genes aren't going to go through me. And so his genes sort of get cut off, and eventually over time you get a male that has to be competitive among other males, or he won't get to the to the point of having a territory. And then he's got to also satisfy the female's demands. And, of course, this is all genetically carried because, medflies don't have intellect. They can't learn. There's no excuse. It has to be a part of their genetic constitution to have the right moves. And this probably occurs, very, very commonly throughout the animal kingdom, and I suspect in the human world as well. It's something to look for, something to think about.
The thing to think about being that, Rambo may make it through the jungle, but that doesn't mean he'll have any offspring.
Exactly. And it means that that in the human world, the female's ability to reject a suitor has probably had a very important part in shaping what men are today, just the basic nature of the male creature. And in that essay, I was sort of talking tongue in cheek about these various the kinds of ideal males that have been sort of held up by women in the last 20, 30 years, the very sensitive male in the 60s and 70s, and then this sort of narcissistic male that arose. And now, today in the 90s, they want, apparently a male who sort of can be tender and also tough, and it's kind of amusing to me because that's just what the medfly females seem to want in their males, sort of a balance of tenderness and macho toughness.
Too macho and they get popped off the leaf. Too tender, they don't make it onto the leaf.
Exactly.
It's a problem.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's universal.
My guest is Bill Jordan. Mm-hmm. He has he's written a new book. It's called Divorce Among the Gulls. He calls it an uncommon look at human nature. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Jordan is my guest. His book is called Divorce Among the Gulls, and there is an essay about divorce among the gulls. Now, I suppose most of us as children were raised to believe that, among birds, couples are forever, and they're the model of true devotion. And, of course, we've begun to learn lately that, maybe that's not the case, and that birds sue for divorce as well. Especially gulls. What does that mean?
It's true that monogamy is very common in birds. We're finding out now that they're not very faithful. They do a lot of messing around on the side. But in the seagulls that were studied by my friend Judith Hand, she's a biologist, and they found that the gulls tend to mate for life. But over the course of time, it turns out that about 25% of the population end up getting what amounts to divorced. And you have to ask, your first question is, how can gulls be incompatible? I mean, this is just sort of a strange thing. Well, it turns out that you look at the temperament of the gulls, and one of the ways in which temperaments can be incompatible has to do with how much the male and the female want to incubate the eggs. Because in seagulls, the males and females share the mating duties, they share the incubation duties, and the chick feeding and that kind of thing. And The title chapter of the book is called Divorce Among the Gulls, and it's about this one couple and one of their little marital disputes. And it has to do with the male and the female squabbling over who gets to incubate the eggs.
Who gets to sit on the eggs?
Who gets to sit on the eggs. And
doesn't seem like something you'd want to fight over, does it?
No, it doesn't. but the gulls sort of apparently it's a very sensual experience, a very pleasurable experience to settle down over the eggs. They have a patch of feathers falls out. It's called reveals a patch of skin called the brood patch, and the blood vessels come closer to the surface, and this allows the heat to pass directly from the body into the egg. And when you watch these gulls settle over the eggs, they throw their heads back and they shake their heads and they sort of settle down over the eggs and they shake their tails and it just looks like it feels so good. And in this particular essay, the female had to come back and she goes through a ritual, sort of a greeting ritual, which also serves to say, look, I want to take over now. And the male sort of says, hey, I don't want to give the eggs up. And they go through about 15, 20 minutes of this dispute. And finally, the male says, all right. He sort of grumbles and leaves. And then the female settles down. But anyway, if you have a male who wants to incubate 70% of the time, and his mate also wants to incubate 70% of the time, they're going to be squabbling about 40% of the time. And that squabbling, if it's really violent, it can break the eggs or injure the chicks, or it can interfere with the foraging. The chicks won't get fed enough. The adults might not even get fed enough.
It's not good for family life.
No, it's not at all. And if this squabbling is bad enough, if they don't fledge the chicks, if the chicks don't grow up and leave the nest, the next year these couples tend to come back with different mates, and. And I think this seagull model sort of gives you a certain insight on the biological nature of incompatibility, and also it serves to make us realize the kinship, the similarities between us on these very basic levels, and I find that a very provocative and a disturbing and also a very sort of a heartwarming notion, that the idea of kinship, this relationship and similarity in these basic emotional areas.
I suppose it was when you were a student, a young biology student, that you began to get a little bit disturbed about the way in the dissecting lab we separate the animals whom we're carving up sometimes while they're alive.
Yeah, well, in the last essay in the book, it's called Pictures at a Scientific Exhibition. There are four pictures, and the pictures being sort of very realistic descriptions of the way we were taught to kill animals and then work on them in the physiology lab. And also it's about the attitude we were encouraged to take, toward the killing and the vivisection, the live cutting up. Now, this, of course, is central to our medical research and to agricultural research. We simply use animals, and we always say it's all right because it's in the service of human beings, which is a very self-centered thing. And by the way, this is why I believe we have to set ourselves above animals, because it gives us license to do with them as we will. One purpose of science, of scientific training, is to teach you how to separate your irrational mind from your emotional feelings. And I think this has to happen in certain ways. I mean, if you're a physician, you have to get past the revulsion of cutting live flesh. You simply have to. And you do it because you by telling yourself that it's something you have to make yourself do. It's in the service of a higher good, and it is. But at the same time, I think we should recognize that when we unleash that human reason, it has no loyalties. It has no compassion. It can go any direction that it tends to go. You can say, if I cut your nose off, look at that very interesting pattern of arteries. My goodness, that's interesting. But if you follow your natural reactions, you go, oh my God, you almost go into convulsions. It's so horrifying to you. So I think there's a real problem. We have to understand that the human rational mind is a real loaded gun, because when you see life in this sense of kinship, and you realize how closely related all life really is, there's not that much. I mean, this chimpanzee, they think, has 99% of the same genes that we have, and yet we use chimpanzees in AIDS research. That's just pretty unconscionable. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould, I think somewhere in his writing, was saying it's conceivable that you could cross a chimpanzee with a human being and get an offspring. That shows you how closely related we are.
Human beings are also a part of nature, right?
Yes.
So it may be that there's a sorting out going on here. It isn't clear whether human beings will disappear or whether other species will, but I'm not quite sure why there is anything necessarily morally upsetting that some creatures are sacrificed by human beings' triumph, just as humans may at some point be sacrificed to other life forms.
Well, that's a good point. I guess I'm sort of falling victim to my own, sort of human, sense of what fair treatment is. Basically, sort of equal treatment. It's the basis of civil rights and the women's movement, the whole thing, the idea of treating people, equally and fairly, and that upsets me. But you're right. In the larger sense, we're part of nature, and this is the way nature operates, and so it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter.
If we can indeed save ourselves from AIDS at the expense of the chimpanzee, is this an immorality? Or it sounds as though you think it is, that somehow or other we die of AIDS than that the chimps should die in the lab.
Well, we have all the power, so we can say that we're the ones that should live and the chimps should die. But if the chimp had the power, it would reverse things. And I'm simply saying that by setting ourselves separate, we define ourselves as having the power, as being the top species on the ladder. And I don't think this is true in a real sense. It's just because we have the power and you're right. In terms of human morality, it's unfair. But in terms of this great sort of bland, amoral system we call nature. No, it's not unfair. It's not bad. It just simply is. But if we want to live with ourselves as human beings, it seems to me that we should look at ourselves and say, well, this behavior is really pretty bad. I think we know deep down inside, many of us do, and we don't want to face it. It's one of these things that
we know what
we know that we're giving the world a pretty bad shake. But we find it so hard to control ourselves that we haven't been able to this point, and we're not very happy with ourselves about it.
My guest has been William Jordan. He's written a book called Divorce Among the Gulls, An Uncommon Look at Human Nature. I'm Frank Browning. This is Fresh Air. Coming up, All Things Considered marks its 20th anniversary with hosts Robert Siegel in Washington, Linda Wertheimer in Chicago, and Noah Adams in New Mexico. There'll be reports on more billion-dollar losses in the auto industry, belt tightening and unemployment payments, a new mineral treaty for Antarctica, and also a special report on how the elderly are inventing alternative choices for retirement. Those and other stories coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our language is constantly changing. Linguist Jeff Nunberg says it can sometimes be a poignant experience to watch a particularly colorful word headed for obscurity.
When I was in my teens, I always had this clear picture of how it was going to be. She was going to look like Jean Arthur or Barbara Stanwyck. And at a certain point, she was going to stamp her pretty little foot and look up at me and say, "You big galoot, can't you see I'm crazy about you?" Only I grew up too short and too late. My frame is not what you'd call galootish, and anyway, the word was all but extinct by the time I reached my majority. I'm not one of those people who fear for the state of Western civilization every time the language changes, but I'll miss galoot, and I'm kind of puzzled it's gone. Sometimes a word has to be put out to pasture when it's outlived its usefulness. I have a certain nostalgia for antimacassar, furbelow, and poop deck on purely phonetic grounds, but I can see that it would have been impractical to try to keep them around. And other words are predestined to burn out after brief meteoric careers. It's not surprising you don't hear groovy and far out anymore. Words like those are the Nancy Sinatras and Tommy Sands of the English lexicon. But galoot has been doing quiet, useful work for more than 100 years, and it isn't as if there was suddenly nothing more to apply it to. The woods are still full of galoots, Randy Quaid, Roger Clemens, John Kenneth Galbraith, only now we have to find something else to call them. It isn't just slang words this happens to. Whatever became of dudgeon, meaning indignation, as in the sentence, "The roacher stumps back to the dugout in high dudgeon." This one has been around since the mid-16th century, and then it seems suddenly to have vanished, like someone who stepped out to buy a pack of cigarettes in August of 1952 and was never heard from again. And where did geegaw go after 700 years of honorable service? Or chum, which has been around since Dryden's time? Just think of the publisher that reissues all of the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew books, having to hire legions of editors whose job it is to scratch out every occurrence of chum and replace it with friend or pal. When I checked these words in the dictionary, I found they shared a curious property. Galoot, dudgeon, geegaw, and chum are all marked with the haunting phrase of obscure origin. Lexicographers like to speculate about where they came from, of course, and you can always find some word in another language that sounds like the word you're interested in. Eric Partridge thought that galoot might have come from the Dutch word galoot, meaning eunuch, but he had no evidence for the connection and no account of why that word should turn up in English meaning an oafish fellow. Or maybe it's from the French galut, meaning glutton. You can make up your own story about this one. This is what makes etymology such an entertaining pastime, but with some words, there's simply no way to tell where they came from. I think of these as Heathcliff words. They're these dark strangers that show up on the doorstep one day to claim their place in the linguistic household. Some of them are sent to sleep in the barn, like galoot. Others, like dudgeon, plop themselves down brazenly at the dinner table. Yet there's always something a little different about them. And maybe it's foreordained that one day they should slip away just as mysteriously as they arrived. Will they come back as ghosts, then? Words do that sometimes. Take swell. It's been a generation or two since the word was last used in earnest, but people do still say it ironically. That's a swell idea, as if to say, where are you coming from, 1940? It would make a nicely romantic ending for the story. Someday I'll look up and glimpse the spirits of galoot and dudgeon gliding over the moor like Heathcliff and Kathy.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy, Robbie Harris, and Roberta Sharrock. For Terry Gross, I'm Frank Browning.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cholesterol-free donuts? No-fat burgers? Fact or fiction? On the next Fresh Air, we examine the growing trend to make junk foods healthy. I'm Frank Browning. Join us for the next Fresh Air.